My name is Nicole Mintines. I am 34 years old. Today is October 11th, 2019. And I am speaking with Eileen Gardner, who is my mother-in-law. And we're recording this interview in Vancouver, BC. And Eileen, oh, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hold it like that. Yeah. My name is Eileen Gardner. I'm 80 years old, 80 years old, and I live in Fife in Scotland, and I'm here with my son Ollie and his beautiful wife and wonderful grandson. We're here for a week, and we're having a great time.
Okay. So the first question is, it's going to go into like family history, start kind of basic. Let's see. Where is your mom's family from? Let's put it here.
My mom's family came from a place called Dalston in London. That's the east end of London. We had a big family. Yeah, a large family.
That's okay. You don't have just. So the next thing is, where's your dad's family from?
Right. Well, my real father, I didn't really know, because my parents were divorced when I was a little baby, but his family also came from the East End of London, but I would say it was more the posh side of the East End of London, so I couldn't actually say the exact place. I think at some stage he lived in Islington in London, but that's about as far as I know. I do know I had an Uncle Dick who was the what they called a city toff. He worked in the stock exchange in London, and he was quite a well-to-do man, and I met him a couple of times. But as far as the rest of my father's family, I don't really know very much about them at all, which is sad. Yes.
Did you know your grandparents very well?
Oh yes, I love my grandparents to bits. In fact, my mother, because my mother and real father were divorced, and she had me on my own when I was very small because he went off. By the way, he had five wives, and they all were called either Eileen or Irene, because my mother's name was Irene. And that's always been a standing joke as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But my mother, she had a really hard time trying to bring me up. And in fact, in the war, I was what you call a war baby. And I was evacuated to Norfolk to a lovely family. And my mother obviously had to stay in London because of the war. And I lived with my, shall we say, adopted family at that time until I was 3 years old. And then I went into this awful home in the wartime, and after that I lived with my Auntie Florrie and Uncle Sid, which I used to call Auntie Florrie and Uncle Siddy. Uncle Siddy was absolutely wonderful, and then I came back, and then after the war, I lived with my grandma and granddad, and I was very fond of them. We lived with them for a long time until my mother remarried again. But my granddad was always a special person to me, and I used to follow him around all the time, and I used to go down to his workshop, and I used to watch him. He used to make repair shoes for people, and also he used to repair inner tires, which is called something, but I can't remember what it's called. And he was a very clever man, also a very handsome man. But I loved them to bits, my grandparents, and it was very sad when, you know, they eventually died. I knew that my grandfather was always there with me, because I knew when he died, I was on holiday with the Girls Life Brigade. We were in Wales, in Llandudno, and we were walking up the what they call the Great Orm. There's a Great Orm and the Little Orm, which are mountains. Mm. And we were walking up there, and one day I just suddenly stopped, and one of the friends I was with said, "Is anything wrong?" And I just turned around and said, "Yes, I think my granddad's just died." Mm. And in fact, he had died at that moment. So that shows how very, very close we were. And I always felt that he came to me in my dreams. Mm. I always used to see him in my dreams. And that happened for quite a long period of time. And then, obviously, possibly when the time came for me to feel more, you wouldn't say happy that somebody has gone, but obviously I came to terms with it. Then he seemed to disappear and he didn't come back. So, but that was always very, very, very close. I was very fond of them, always.
Grandparents are special people.
They are, yeah, yeah.
Let's go to the next question. Are you sure you've... No, oh wait, no. Okay. Oh, who are your favorite relatives? Can you describe what they looked like? So perhaps the ones that are no longer with us.
Okay. Well, I suppose, let's say, my past favourite relatives, as I said, there were three of them. That's my Auntie Florrie, Uncle Siddy, and my granddad. Now, my Auntie Florrie was about 5'2", probably 5'3", in height. She was plump. And we all have what they call the Crompton behind. That was her name, the Crompton. We all have very big bottoms, so they called it the Crompton behind. It's quite funny, really, because all the women in the family have got this Crompton behind. My Uncle Siddy was very slim. He had a bald head, from what I can remember. Always a smiley face. He always used to tickle my kneecaps to make me laugh. I do remember very well. But he was a lovely man. He was very slim. He was quite handsome in his own way, and as I said, with a bald head. My grandfather had, he was about 5'10", I would say. He was quite a tallish man in those days. He had a beard and a moustache and a shock of hair. A very, very handsome man, a very clever man. He was average in build. I wouldn't have said he was... He wasn't skinny, he wasn't fat, he was just average. And he smoked a pipe. I do remember that. He used to sit in his little armchair in the corner of the room, and we used to put the little wireless on. You know, they used to have the old-fashioned wireless. And he used to turn it on, and we used to listen to In Town Tonight. And
is that a radio?
Yeah, the little radio, yeah. Yeah, they were really great. And he had his little old armchair, and on the shelf by the side, he had his little pipe. Yeah. And I remember when I was very small, when we lived with them, I used to have my bath in front of the fire in a tin sort of bath, you know, because that's the only place where it was warm, because there was no heating in those days, basically. So that was lovely. And every Christmas, I had to fold it right on a piece of paper and fold it up, and he would put it up the chimney. So that was going to Santa, you know, to see what I wanted.
Oh, that's sweet.
But they were lovely people. They were really lovely people. My grandmother, I suppose she wasn't the most favourite, but she was a lovely person. She was very kind, and she and my Auntie Florrie, right at the end when the men died, they lived together. And one of the most funny things, when I used to go, my grandmother used to call me into the kitchen and say, "Come with me, come with me." And she used to go into her pinny, which was an overall apron that women used to wear in those days. She used to put her hand in her pocket and she used to take out £5 and say, "That's for you." And she'd go, "Off you go, off you go." And then I'd go in the oven, and then my Auntie Florrie used to go into the kitchen and call me and say, come with me," like that. And then she used to do exactly the same thing, put her hand in the pocket and give me a fine. "You mustn't tell Grandma that I've given you that, you know," and then she'd come out all smiles.
You're like, "I'm not telling anyone."
It was lovely. They were great. They were great. I have very, very fond memories of them. Yes, that is my fond sort of childhood time, I would say, yes, of all.
Yeah. How old were you about then?
Well, my mother got married when I was 7, so it was obviously the time when we came back after the war. I was born in 1939, so when the war ended, obviously I came back. And I suppose I lived with them from probably the age of about on and off with Auntie Florrie and Uncle Sid from the age of about four till... I think she brought me home to London when I was about five and a half, six, and then I lived with my grandparents for a long time then, and my mother got remarried again when I was about seven and a half, eight. That's as far as I can remember. I didn't go to school till I was about seven. I didn't start school till I was seven.
Okay. Are there any traditions that have been passed down in your family?
Oh, that's a big one. Well, the only thing as far as a tradition is concerned would be Christmas. I mean, our Christmases were just unbelievable. You know, my Auntie BT, one of my aunts, because we had a big family, had a big house. And I think, as I described before, all the family used to get together every year about a month before Christmas. They all used to come to my grandmother's house and we used to have tea, you know, evening. We used to call it tea then, not supper. And she always used to make smoked haddock and with lots of butter and homemade bread and blackcurrant jam and then cake, fruit cake that she'd made. And after that, table would be cleared and they'd all get out their little writing pads and pencils, and each part of the different families would do different things. Like one would get, say, we'll get all the vegetables, someone would get the turkey, someone would make the Christmas pudding, someone would make the Christmas pie, someone would get all the alcohol and things like that. And then on Christmas Eve, a lot of the time we went to Auntie Beatrice. And when we had lunches and meals, we had all the big trestle tables in her big dining room, and all the adults would sit around there. And then in the conservatory, we used to have a table for all the children, and they didn't care what we did. We just were there on our own because we made too much noise or too much mess.
So the meatball food fights.
Yeah, that was lovely. It was really great. But I think that is the biggest tradition. And one of the things they used to do, which was absolutely fantastic, was on Boxing Day in the evening, they used to go out of the house at Auntie Peter's. We used to go in a line, and we used to do the conga. So all the family used to sort of trail in a big snake, yes. And then we used to knock on people's doors and they used to join in. We used to go all around the streets.
Oh, really?
That's one of the biggest traditions I can think. And every Christmas we used to do that when we were there.
Oh, how fun.
It was absolutely fantastic. We had a wonderful family as far as musicality was concerned. Most people, my mother had a lovely singing voice, my Auntie Hilda had a beautiful singing voice, my Uncle Tom, he made a recording of Bless This House, he had a beautiful baritone voice, and my Auntie Evelyn, she played the piano, and on Christmas Eve we used to sort of all get round the piano and sing sort of Christmas carols. And to me, there'd never been any Christmas that has come up to that level of absolute wonder, you know, because no television then. And we used to play darts in the afternoon. The men used to get the dartboard out and play dart. Some used to get little card tables out. And that's how big the family was, you know. Some would play darts, some would play cards on the little card table. And then in the evening, after supper, we never went to bed very early, I might add. After supper, we used to play Murder in the Dark. You know, you turned off all the lights and somebody had to be the murderer and they had to touch somebody. And then we always used to sort of all play detective and find out who the murderer was when the lights went up. And the other one we used to play was Sardines, where you go, one person has to go and hide. And then when they go around and find them, they have to sit or stand in with them and wait for the next person to find them. So sometimes it was in a wardrobe or closet, and we all used to stand together like sort of sardines all squashed together, which was absolutely lovely. So that was another thing we played, and one of the funniest things we played, and this wasn't till a bit later, I think, when we had Christmases at my parents' house then. They used to put a large sheet on the floor. We all had to kneel round and they used to get a basin, a pudding basin, like where you used to have to make suet puddings, a big pudding basin, and used to pack it with flour, tightly with flour, really tightly, then turn it upside down on a piece of newspaper in the middle of this sheet. And on the top, you put a sweet. And then there was a knife, and it used to go round in turn, and each person had to cut a little slice of this flour, because it was just flour, and try and take it away very, very carefully. And then the knife would be passed to the next person. If you let the whole thing fall, whoever let it fall had to put their hands behind their back and try and get the sweetie out with their mouth and to get covered in flour. So that was the other thing we used to do, which was great.
Have you heard the game Jenga before, where you pull the blocks out?
Oh, that's it, yeah. Similar sort of thing, except you with flour.
But that seems way more fun.
Yeah, it was, because when you're little, it was even more fun. And then the last game we used to play was somebody used to be a cat, and we all used to have sit round in a circle, and one person had to come up, and you couldn't smile or anything. You had to keep an absolute straight poker face. And the person being the cat would have to come up and pretend to be pussy and stroke your leg with its head and purr and, you know, try and make you smile, and you had to keep a straight face. And if you didn't and you laughed, then you had to take turns to be the cat. So that was the other thing. Then I suppose the largest thing, really, tradition in our family was a card. They were a big card-playing family of everything, every type of game, poker, everything. We never played for money. It was always for matchsticks or sweets, little smarties or things like that. And we had a couple of people in the family that were very bad losers, and that was funny as well. Because, you know, if you're tiny, it was all great fun. But I learned to play cards at a very young age because of that, you know, which is great, you know.
Where Ollie gets it from.
I think so, yes. Mind you, his father, Tom's a good card player as well, so I think it was on both sides, but it was definitely a big tradition with our family, yeah.
That's great. That's great. Can you tell me about one of the people who has been kindest to you in your life?
Been kindest to me? Well, I think the person who's been most kindest to me is my husband.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, the state I'm in now, I suppose, not many men would put up with someone that can't do as much as I can't do. I know I still work and I paint and everything, but he does everything now. He does the garden, he cooks, very good cook. He looks after me, he takes me to work and back. And, you know, he has to massage my feet because they're sore. And oh, really, basically, all these sort of things that, you know, I used to be very fit and be able to do, and now I can't do. So I suppose, in a way, apart from him, which I suppose in the latter part of my life, he's been one of the kindest. I think in the early days, it was just my Auntie Florrie and Uncle Sidney that really were the kindest people to me, because they didn't have to take me in. They didn't have to look after me, and they just, because they had two sons, Lenny and Eddie, and they wanted their mother to adopt me, you know, as their sister. But apart from that, I think they were the ones that, but Tom now, I mean, he couldn't do without him at all. He's wonderful. He's really wonderful. Yeah.
Well,
he knows this, so it won't be making him big-headed or anything. And I always say he's such a good cook, and when I tell everybody where I work and where I teach at Higham Hall, they always say, can you not rent him out to us? But no, he's really wonderful, yeah.
I'm glad Ollie had such a good role model as a
boy. Yeah, I think Ollie absolutely loves his dad to bits. I mean, when he found out that we were separated in the early days, I think that upset Ollie quite a bit. I think he had me more or less on a pedestal until then. This is my feeling, I might be wrong, but I feel that when I told him, that was a big shock to him. But the others knew, Lewis knew and Sam knew, and I'd never told Ollie, but then I did, because I kept saying to him, you're not perfect, you know, because Ollie likes perfect things.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I said, but you're not perfect. nobody's perfect. And I said, no, I'm certainly not perfect. So that's when I told him. So.
Oh.
But I mean, I know if he was in a better situation, he'd also, or both of you, you'd be very kind to us as well. I love all my children a bit, so I mean, you know.
That's the first time I've heard that you separated. When was that?
That was a couple of years after we were married.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it was before children?
Oh, yes, yes, way before children. I would never in a million years have done it then. But no, I think what it was, we were very young. Tom was very young when he got married. I really hadn't had any proper boyfriends as such. I'd had one. Maybe two that lasted just a short period of time. So I didn't, and came from a very insecure home, very insecure background, which in a way was sad. So I never knew security. I'm still a very insecure person now, but I found that Tom being younger, and he'll say it himself, we may not think to say it, but he put me on a pedestal as far as I was concerned. I could do no wrong, which I did. Obviously, I sort of went off with somebody else. And I soon found out that was a mistake, and luckily he took me back, which was, well, that is another story, so yeah. That would be too long to sort of put on here.
Another chapter.
Yeah, but he did, and then as Tom's aunt always used to say, it's like a love story from a book. If you read it in a book, you'd think, well, that couldn't possibly be true, but it was, and he did. And it was great, and you know, we had a long talk about it when we got back together, whether we were going to work or not. And we had our little bits of, you know, ups and downs from them, and he had his sort of flings after that as well, just to pay me back, I think. But we got it sorted, and as I say, it's a long story, which I'm not frightened to tell at all, and you know, I'm a very open person. I would talk about anything, so, you know.
I love that you are imperfect and that you're willing to, you know, not hide it. I feel like in my side of the family, a lot of those, it would never, it's very hush-hush because it wouldn't be shared.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for us to...
Well, I think so, because you realise that people make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Things do go wrong, and... After that, I said to Tom, you know, when we first got back together after that, I felt that I was treading on, not eggshells, but I had to be careful about everything I did. I had to do everything to please him. And that's, I think, when he went off with somebody else, because it wasn't that he went away, he just somebody in the theatre he had an affair with. But I think he realised, and I suddenly realised, I've got to be my own person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a person in my own right. What am I doing? You know, I'm being almost like a doormat.
Right.
And no, this is not who I am. So that's when I became my own person more, and think, no, I've got my rights and I've got to do what I feel is good for me. So that's when we got back, and that's when things started to go well, you know.
It's the ebb and flow in relationships,
oh,
right?
Absolutely.
When you're trying to
anybody's going to have ups and downs, and if they don't realise that, it's sad, because you're never going to agree with every single thing. I don't like... Tom doesn't argue.
Mm.
He's a quiet person. He will look at me over the top of his glasses. You know, sort of frown at me, and I'll go wham, that's where Oliver gets his door slamming from. I'll go out and slam the door and everything will shatter, and I'll throw things and things like that. But he doesn't like to argue, and I think sometimes some men find it very difficult to talk. He does. He doesn't find it easy to open up. And I think, I always feel with Ollie that he can talk. I think he's the only one. Sam finds it a bit difficult, but once she opens up, she will. My eldest son, Lewis, I think he's like Tom, I don't think he can open up very easily.
Mm.
I've never known him to open up, apart from when he was very young.
Mm.
And that I had to drag out of him, basically, you know. But No, it's important. Talking is the most important thing. Doesn't matter what's wrong, to talk about it is the most important thing you can do. I've learned that from being a depressive, which I am, and I don't mind saying it. I'm clinically a depressive, and I will have bad days when I think, why am I here? You know, what's the point? Especially as I am now, I feel that very strongly. But then, as Tom then will turn around and say, look what you've done with your life. You know, not a lot of people would have done that. So I suppose that side of me I've got to feel okay about. But I was told when I had to see psychiatrists and everything, and I was on antidepressants for about 2.5 years, I was told, you have to talk. Talking is the most important thing. But if you harbour it, it can make you ill and make things go wrong. You might bore somebody to tears, but it really doesn't matter. Well, you've just got to get it out, you know.
It's not your people if they're not willing to listen.
I know. And this is what I find, and I'm not going to talk about her on here because it's not fair, but I find certain members of the family that haven't got that empathy, that couldn't do this, and you can't get through to. And I feel that's very sad. Because I think if everybody aired their grievances, if you said to me, like, well, yes, we're fond of you, but I don't like the way you do this and I don't think you should do that, I might think, oh, you know, like that. But I don't think I would take umbrage. I think, all right, well, I'm not doing that right. Let's change it. What should I do? But some people just couldn't cope with that at all. And they would sort of think, and take the half and off they go. But I don't believe in that at all. No, I think that love is the most important thing, no matter what, you know. You've got love, you've got everything, you know.
And love includes loving the bad parts of people,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
The good with the bad, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when it's like after you've had a baby, I mean, poor Tom, I think he used to fit. He was second fiddle all the time for a long, 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 long time. Because, I mean, it's a lot for a woman to cope with having a baby. And they don't teach you this. You just have to get on with it. And you have to go through sleepless nights, and go through discomfort, pain. And, you know, and your body has to get right again. And until it does get right, you don't really feel like, go away. You know?
We don't need to make another baby. No. Or practice, for that matter.
No, that's very true, yeah. No, I, as I say, I think love and talking are the most important. I think you can get through anything if you can talk and you love. And I think if that's there, then no matter what, life is okay. Everything's, I mean, life's not going to be smooth all the time. It never is. I mean, we nearly lost our house when Tom was made redundant. I remember standing by the window because the kids were quite young. And I thought, we struggled to get this place. I'm blowed if anything's going to take it away from us. And there was that pure determination to make sure that never happened. And I worked as a cleaner. Tom was out of work. I worked as a cleaner. I worked in an old people's home. But I quite enjoyed that because I met all different elderly people and, you know, things like that, which was, it was good. Again, you respected the elderly then because you could see what some of these were going through. They might have been grumpy old so-and-sos, and I won't use the word I was going to use. But but there again, you could appreciate why, you know.
Everyone has something to teach you, or a lesson you can learn, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see. Of course, we're not going to throw all my questions, but let's see. I think you already answered that one. What are some of the most important lessons you've learned in life, and how did you learn them?
Well, I think we talked about how I learned them, but the most important lessons I've learned, as I said, is to be kind to people and to be understanding towards people. You know, you get impatient with people, say, for instance, me trying to cross a road, that I'm slow, and you get people in cars thinking, why the hell doesn't she get a move on, and things like that. You've got to be kind to people. You've got to appreciate that not everybody's life is perfect. Not everybody is capable of moving as quickly as you can. And also, as I say, bring Fauna again to talk to people and to love people. But kindness and love, I think, are two of the most important things. There's no reason to be unkind, and there's no reason to be unkind to people because they're of a different colour or anything like that. We're all human beings on this earth, you know, we're all human. So therefore we should all be treated accordingly, which of course in some circumstances is not going to happen. Whether it ever will, I don't know. But I just feel, you know, we're all human, we've all got our failings, we've all got our good parts, but we should be kind and help everybody, help one another. It's not always possible, but help when you can and be kind and to love.
And have you always felt this way, or did you learn it when you were a certain age?
I suppose at an early age I learned about being kind to people of a different race, yes, because there were certain members in my family when I was very young. You see, in the East End of London, where we grew up, you used to get a lot of mixed race families, and they used to live in houses, and they were cramped full, you know, they didn't have space or anything. And I think some people around that area might have got very cross because they used to say they were dirty and, you know, they put all their rubbish where they shouldn't have done and things like that. And I just feel, I felt that in my family. And at the school I went to, we had all races in the school I went to. I went to a lovely high school, and we had which in those days we could call black people, because let's face it, we're all different colours, and those that sing us white or whatever we're supposed to call them now, we're all of a different colour. Because I'm an artist, I can see that probably more than others. But, you know, and I think I learned at a very early age that these are just humans, and you've got to treat them accordingly. You know, why treat them differently? And that made me angry, and I think that first came to light when I was about 15 with my family. Not my immediate family, but with people in the family. And so that made me think. And when I was at school, because I mixed with these people, they were no different than me. They might have different colour skin, but they were no different. So I think that was the stage when I realised that you've got to be kind, and you've got to be tolerant, and, you know, it's... As far as love is concerned, I think I didn't learn that very much in my childhood, apart from my Auntie Florrie and Uncle Siddy. They gave me lots and lots of love, what they could. So did my grandparents. Obviously, I loved my mother. She was my mother, but I didn't get the amount of love that I think a child should have got from her. And also, again, from the children in my family, you know, my own children, and also my husband, you know.
Yeah, no, it's just
and there's a lot of love coming from him, even though it gets fed up with me at times.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's natural.
I know. Yeah, it's only natural. I get fed up with him too, so.
That's true, so. What are you proudest of?
Of what I've achieved, what I've done in my life.
And why does it make you feel proud?
First and foremost, I'm proud that I actually had children, because I didn't think I could. So that's the very first. Because being told I couldn't have any, and then suddenly having one, that was fantastic. And then having another, and then suddenly having a third, that made me very proud and feel very, very happy. And then later on in life, I suppose it's having the confidence and having the get up and go and push myself to do my art in a way. You know, I think that was very important. First of all, it was because I did it for my own satisfaction. And then afterwards, to help others. And I realised that if I could help my own child where it started, then I could help other people as well. So I think that, and the fact that I've worked now at teaching adults for 32 years, I suppose in a way that's my proudest thing, really.
And you didn't start doing art until you were in your 30s.
Yeah, I didn't start doing it. Obviously,
I can't comment.
That's fine.
It's okay. It's part of the background.
Bouncy, yeah. Yeah. Oh. That's little Hendrix, by the way.
Yes, exactly. The background.
Yes. He's getting tired. He's going on his bouncy and having a good old bounce.
But when Hendrix listens to this, when he's 20 years from now.
No. Didn't expect this little one.
Okay. All is well.
Yeah, all is well. So, yeah, I think, yes, having worked like that. When I first started to paint again was when... after I'd had the children, and I started then, and then I had to teach my son how to do some sort of homework. He had technical drawing. I thought, well, if I can teach him, I can teach anybody. So that's when I started, and I started in the school locally, and then I was asked to have an exhibition where I work now, and then from that exhibition, the woman that was running the classes then was leaving, and she saw me a workshop that I was doing, and she said, would you like to come and teach when I leave? So that started me off there. That's how I started. And it's gone from strength to strength, and I realized that I have got the ability to teach, and also the ability, because I love people, and you know, I'm almost like a counsellor to a lot of people. They come and tell me all their troubles and their problems. And again, this is kindness again and helping others that has made me feel good. And obviously that's why I got my award, because of that, you know.
And tell us, the world, more about your award.
Well, I got an award. I got the British Empire Medal from the Queen. And I got that, the Queen of England, I say that, because it's called the British Empire Medal, and I got it for teaching adults, which I've done for 32 years, and also for the arts in Fife. Not only because I'm teaching, but I also show my work, and I've exhibited my work for many years and sold work to obviously a lot of people, and I've worked on it to other countries. And also they called me the mother hen, and the person I work for, that's what he said. And one of the reasons I got the award is because of, as he put it, and this is not my words, as he put it, my kindness to other people and my willing to help other people. And that's one of the reasons I got it, yeah.
Oh, something to be very proud of. So there's many things to be proud of. Okay, we've got two more questions. How has your life been different than what you had imagined?
Oh, gosh. Well, right in the very beginning, very, very early days, I wanted to be a concert pianist. Mm. When I was at school, I played the piano, and I loved music, and I used to have piano lessons. I did all my exams up to cap and gown, Royal Schools of Music in London. And I really, really want to be a concert pianist. I saw a professor and he said, you have the inspiration, and now what he called was the 1% inspiration, and now you need the 99% perspiration. But you also need somebody behind you to support you, which I didn't have. And so that sort of fell by the wayside. And when I say support, in those days you had to have somebody to financially support you to do this. So I think that was just out of the question, because my immediate family then weren't really interested in me doing that. I was told I need to go out and get a proper job, basically. So
it's okay. How is your life different than what you thought it would have been?
Okay, so that was that. Then after that, I wanted to be a games teacher, because I realised I couldn't do that.
A games teacher?
Yes, that's teaching tennis and netball and gym and things like that, because I'm very good at tennis. I actually got as far as just before the trials for Junior Wimbledon, I got as far as that.
Oh, wow.
And I had to play, God, I can't remember her name. She was quite a well-known British player.
Ollie would know.
Anne something, I think her name was, and I played her in the runner-up to the junior sort of trials, but she knocked me for six, basically. So, but I really, really would like to have been a games teacher, and the games teacher I had at school was very keen that I would do that. So she used to, when I was in the sixth form, she used to make me take half the class. She used to take half and I used to take half. So I was well able to teach in those days. And although I had a very bad stammer in my earlier youth, when I talked, it absolutely disappeared. And that's why she put me forward for an interview at the lovely sort of private girls' school that was for people to be sort of games teachers. She put me forward there for an interview. But of course, when I went for the interview, because I came from the East End of London, everyone around there was very, very, very posh, very well heeled, which is meaning very well off. And when I got inside for the interview and she started to talk to me, of course, I was nervous and I started to stammer. And so she just turned around to me and said, "Well, my dear, we don't think this is right for you. You will find your niche in life somewhere." And that was the end of the interview because I stammered, you know. When these days, that wouldn't be the issue at all. So those are the things I really wanted to do. And then, of course, after that, I just worked in an office. And it wasn't, as I've already said, until later life that I realised that maybe this is where the art comes in, which it hadn't come in for all those years. And maybe this is the something I should do and help other people to do, and which I get far more out of, really, in a way of teaching others, you know, to bring out their talents than I do even producing work myself. Everything I do now, everything I sell, it's like the first time. I am so proud when somebody buys something of mine. I don't take it for granted. I just think, oh, they want something, you know, and it's such a lovely feeling. So I think now that obviously was the path I was meant to go in, even though that's not where I started.
It just took you some time to get there. And that's myself, as I'm looking into a new career path, I'm glad that you're a shining example of what's possible. For your great-great-grandchildren, so Hendrix's children, listening to this years from now, is there any wisdom you'd want to pass on to them? And what would you want them to know?
Right, I think one of the biggest things for them is to be happy. To me, that is the most important. I'm looking at little Hendrix now, who's one of my grandchildren, my last grandchild at the moment, probably will be the last, but I would just want him and all my other grandchildren to have a happy life. To be successful would be lovely, but that is a plus. I think the most important thing in life is to be happy no matter what. I think he's looking at the dog, Kona, now. I'm trying to talk to him. Oh, no, Kona's up there. He's looking at something. But, hi, Hendrix. All I want is for you to be happy and to have a really good life. And for his children and maybe the children after that is to have happiness and fulfillment in their life. And if they want to be successful, if they want to sort of go on and be prime ministers or whatever, yes, that's fine. But if they do want to have that sort of career, never forget to be kind to people.
Kindness first.
He doesn't know what he's looking at, but he's talking to something. He's really having a conversation. Is that the ball or something? There's something tucked away there.
Hi.
So can you hear that one? Yes.
Hi.
You've got to be happy.
You'd be as jolly as you are now for the rest of your life.
That would be lovely. Oh, it's not always going to happen, we know that, but if you can aim to be, take each day as it comes and to enjoy each day as it comes as much as you can.
That's lovely. We made it. So we've got 55 seconds left, and I think you did great. Anything else you want to save for posterity?
Yeah, I'd love my children to be very happy too.
Are your children?
I know where I'm staying now with Ollie and Nicole. They're wonderful people. Nicole is a super mum, a wonderful, wonderful
Imperfect.
Yeah, well, lots of learning today. Maybe imperfect, but nobody's perfect. But she's a wonderful daughter-in-law, and I'm really, really happy that Ollie found her and married her. That's great. Oh. I couldn't be happier, actually. Knock at all. That's really lovely.
Well, thank you for being a part of our story.
That's okay.
And letting me do interview you. And hopefully I'll get to do this with Tom separately and see what his answers are. Okay, signing off.